Cook. He's the director of the Superfund Research Program, and he would like to say a few words before we get started. Bill?
Thank you, Heather. Hello, and welcome to the first session of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program Progress in Research webinar series. This series will feature work being initiated by grantees who received SRP multi-project grants in 2017. The SRP is the university-based multi-project P42 center grant program. SRP centers build teams of scientists and engineers from different research disciplines to address complex issues related to reducing exposures to potentially hazardous substances, reducing environmental cleanup costs, and improving public health. The purpose of these webinars is to facilitate a dialogue between researchers, field practitioners, in the early stages of the research progress so that these new programs are on a trajectory for successful technology transfer and application by end users. Many of the centers in this series are not necessarily brand new, including the two today. Although they had previous grant cycles, they have added exciting new aspects to their grants as well as innovative ongoing research. I am really excited to hear about the excellent SRP work being done by Duke University and the University of Arizona. I want to thank you all for joining us today. I would also like to encourage everyone to join us for the upcoming sessions on September 4th, September 10th, and October 1st. Thank you, and Heather, it's yours.
Thank you, Bill. All right, we're ready to get started. First, I would like to introduce the team at Duke University. We will hear from Ruth Julio, the Sally Glover Professor of Environmental Toxicology in the Duke Nicholas University. Meyer, the Alex Brown and Sons Associate Professor of Molecular Environmental Toxicology at the Duke Nicholas School of the Environment, and Dr. Claudia Gunch, the Theodore Kennedy Associate Professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Duke University. More information about each presenter is available on the Clue-In seminar homepage. At this point, I would like to pass it off to the Duke SRP team, and let's see if we can hear from Dr. DiGiulio.
Okay, thank you, Heather and Bill. Yes, I'm Richard DiGiulio, Director of the Duke Superfund Research Center. So as Bill mentioned, we are a recurring center. This is our fourth funding cycle, and here are the formal titles of our four cycles. And you can see there is one recurrent term in there, development, which has always been sort of our centerpiece, is our concern for developmental effects. Our theme is early life exposures, later life consequences of the current center. And this is in parallel with the DOHAD theory of developmental origins of health and disease. The Duke Center has five research projects and six research support cores. It includes 16 faculty from the Nicholas School of the Environment, the Pratt School of Engineering, and the Medical School at Duke, as well as the Arts and Science School. And we have one, Seth Coleman from North Carolina State University. And I'll note that all of the projects and cores are represented here today, so you feel free to ask questions about any of these projects and cores. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Joel Meyer and Claudia Gunch. Joel is going to talk about our three biomedical projects, 1 through 3, and Claudia about our non-biomedical projects, 4 and 5. Joel.
Thanks, Rich. So I'll start by talking about the first project. This project is led by PIs Ed Levin, Ted Slotkin, and Fred Seidler. And they're working to understand how exposures to neurotoxic chemicals impact brain development. This is critical as opposed to just understanding how a chemical might affect a developed neuron or developed brain, because these exposures can lead to changes in the structure and formation of the developing brain that are then persistent throughout life and can alter function throughout life. The project. Project one is working with the three compounds shown at the bottom, triphenylphosphate, which is a flame retardant and plasticizer, benzoepyrene, which is a one of a class of compounds referred to as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that result from the burning or combustion of organic matter, in particular fossil fuels, and diazinon organophosphate pesticide. These act in different ways at the molecular level. One of the interesting questions that Project One is trying to address is whether, even though they act in a different way at the molecular level, do they converge in common pathways in terms of how they affect brain development? In addition to trying to understand how the exposure to chemicals such as these affects brain development, they're trying to understand the mechanisms by which these changes occur at the biochemical as well as morphological and also behavioral levels. So they're looking at behavior changes in adult organisms exposed, again, as Rich mentioned, early in development. It's important to understand these mechanisms in part because if we do understand the mechanisms that lead to these changes and what changes are occurring, this may give us insight into therapies. And that's also an interest of this project, to understand if people are exposed and suffer consequences, are there ways to help them? Finally, although they've done a lot of their work in traditional toxicological models such as rats and cell culture, they have done a lot of their more recent work in newer models such as zebrafish and have transferred many of their tools as well as research questions to that model, which has advantages that we'd be happy to talk about compared to some of the more traditional models. Project two, altering the balance of adipogenic and osteogenic regulatory pathways from early life exposure to environmental chemicals, led by PIs Heather Stapleton, Seth Coleman, and Lee Ferguson. This project is examining ways in which, once again, developmental exposure to chemicals can lead to changes in the fate or the differentiation pattern of cells in the developing organism, with a particular focus on changes in cells that are destined to become fat cells or bone cells. One of the big motivations for this is there's been a very large and rapid increase in the percentage of the United States population that is obese. This has been going up very rapidly in recent decades. And that change, the speed of the change, the magnitude of the change, cannot be explained simply by genetics or even by changes in caloric intake or activity level. And increasing data suggests that this may be partly the result of exposure to chemicals during development, which is what this project is looking at. So they are looking at chemicals, including those shown on the right, which are, again, mostly flame retardants. One chemical also used as a plasticizer or metabolites of those flame retardants. As well as complex mixtures such as household dust. And in their work, they will expose, or they are exposing cells in culture as well as zebrafish to these compounds or these mixtures of compounds and asking whether it changes the ways in which those cells develop. You can see an example of that for cells in culture at the bottom left. And you can see a transgenic zebrafish with a green fluorescent protein expressed specifically in different cell types. Allowing examination of changes to the morphology or distribution of those specific cell types after exposure in the living organism. Project three is looking at persistent mitochondrial and epigenetic effects of early life toxicant exposure. The PIs are Joel Meyer and Susan Murphy. We are exposing C. elegans, which is a small nematode worm, as well as cells in culture, to chemicals that affect mitochondrial function. We refer to them as mitotoxicants, and measuring effects of those exposures both on the adult of that generation but also their offspring and the next two generations. So the schematic at the bottom illustrates what we're doing. We would take the worm or a cell in culture and expose it to one of several chemicals. And then grow up the next three generations without any exposure and ask about effects on mitochondrial function, organismal health, as well as changes to the epigenetic patterning of the DNA of these models. The chemicals we're looking at are benzoepyrene, which I've already mentioned, the important metal pollutants, arsenic and mercury, pentachlorophenol, which is a pesticide, triphenylphosphate and diazinon, which I've already mentioned, as well as a mixture of chemicals derived in significant part from creosote at a Superfund site that we work at in Virginia, and you'll be hearing more about that in the context of Project 4's work. Another aspect of Project 3 is understanding the ways in which different people may be more or less sensitive to the same exposure to a mitochondrial toxicant. As it turns out, there are a number of biological pathways and proteins that protect our mitochondria against stressors and toxicant exposures. However, there are differences in those genes in different people in the population, and a fairly large proportion of the population, around 1 in 4 or 5,000 people, is affected by a mutation in a gene affecting mitochondrial homeostasis. A few examples are shown in the table on the upper left. These are mutations in genes leading to human disease that affect the ways in which mitochondria fuse together or divide or are recycled when they're highly damaged. And we can visualize these processes either in a cell in culture, as shown on the bottom left, or in our worm model, as shown in the bottom right. And so what we're doing is using strains of the worms that have mutations in the same genes that are mutated in people with these diseases and asking whether they are more sensitive to these exposures than the worms that are wild type or have the normal gene sequence. That wraps up our three biomedical projects. I'm going to turn it over now to Claudia Gunsch, who will be talking about our non-biomedical projects.
Thanks, Joel. So the Duke Superfund Research Center has two non-biomedical projects. The first project is led by Dr. DiGilio with co-PI Dave Hinton. And this project is looking at the mechanisms and consequences of evolved adaptation to environmental pollution. The overall key question that this project is looking at is how does pollution drive evolution and how this information can be used to inform environmental management. In particular, this research team is interested in understanding how the effects of environmental changes on some of the adapted populations. In their work, the research team links effects of specific chemicals individually as well as mixtures to understand the effects on cardiovascular and nervous systems. And this research is done in fish but has great relevance to human and ecological health. So this team has been working in the Elizabeth River for quite some time now through the various centers that we've had here at Duke. The Elizabeth River has a lot of creosote contamination, and creosote contamination is the result of previous wood treatment that took place in the Elizabeth or near the Elizabeth River. One of the main contaminants that is found as creosote is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and a few of those PAHs are shown up here, and that's the primary focus in terms of chemicals for this research project. In their research, as I mentioned, they work primarily with Atlantic killifish. This is a great model because they don't travel very far, which allows this team to really look at subpopulations and really be able to determine what the impacts of specific pH exposure patterns are on those fish. So in this project, they are elucidating the omic differences between various killifish subpopulations and trying to understand how those organisms have adapted resistance to PAHs, and also determining what the associated physiological impacts are on this fish in terms of fitness costs. So as part of their research, they use a variety of different tools, and they're looking at organismal differences as well as impacts on specific organs and tissues, and then also investigations at the cellular and molecular levels, and also interact with some of our cores within the center, which Rich will introduce a little bit later. The second non-biomedical project, Project 5, looks at engineering the physical-chemical environment to enhance bioremediations of PAHs. I serve as the PI for this project and in collaboration with Dr. Shi Kim, Dr. Wisner, and Dr. Vilgalis. So again, in this project, we are also focusing on polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. The typical way to remediate pH is very intrusive and relies on excavation of sediments or soils, or through capping are the two most common treatment approaches. In our project, we're looking at bioremediation. Bioremediation can be done in situ and is a much less intrusive treatment technology. However, one of the challenges associated with bioremediations of PAHs is the bioavailability of these compounds. So these compounds are extremely hydrophobic and attached to sediment or soil particles, which makes it difficult for the microbes to actually break them down. So in some of our work, what we've done is we have focused on fungi. Fungi are a type of microbe that is typically not used or not the primary focus of bioremediation. However, fungi have nice attributes for PAHs because they secrete extracellular enzymes that can actually break down these PAHs, which make them more amenable to further breakdown by bacteria. And so in our work, really the overarching concept is really to improve the fungal and bacterial cooperation to enhance overall PAH biodegradation. So to accomplish this, we have three ongoing projects that are really in parallel. The first one is developing microbial association networks where we actually go to contaminated sites with varying levels of contamination and draw associations between the geochemical characteristics, the chemical characteristics, and the microbial community at those sites. And we are developing biostatistical models to be able to predict how those communities would evolve over time. In parallel, we are doing some studies in the lab where we're looking at specific amendments to enhance the growth of biofilms, cooperative biofilms between fungi and bacteria to optimize the degradation of PAHs. And finally, we are looking at the development of composite materials that would promote the growth of these cooperative biofilms, but that would also be amenable to deployment at a site for bioremediation in the future. So with that, I will turn it over to Rich to talk about some of our support work.
Thank you, Claudia. So here are listed the six research support cores. Heather Staple and I are run the administrative core. Joel Meyer, who's here, also directs the training core. I want to talk a little bit more about those four other cores. The neurobehavioral toxicity core is directed by Ed Levin, a professor in the psychiatry and behavioral sciences department here, and the medical center also has a joint appointment in the Nicholas School. We kind of briefly touched on that, but what while Ed kind of began his career with more traditional rodent model, he has in the interim expanded to other models such as the zebrafish and the killifish, and now very recently the nematode. And so here are the types of endpoints that he can get at: activity, emotional health, learning, cognition. And these then are become important endpoints for these early life exposures, and they're very important, particularly for projects 1, 3, and 4. Next slide. Our analytical chemistry core is the PI is Lee Ferguson, the co-PI is Heather Stapleton and Helen Shukim. Lee is actually a joint professor in the Pratt School of Engineering and the Nicholas School. And really this core is used by all five projects and both the community engagement and research translation core. So it's a real critical core for us, obviously helping to establish exposures and so forth in all our systems and in field studies. So they're able to measure metals, PAHs, flame retardants, pesticides, on and on. And I'll just mention too that that Lee Ferguson has recently been highly involved in the development of this perfluorinated alkyl substance network established with a $5 million grant from the state of North Carolina. And so the mass spec facilities that Heather and Lee have are phenomenal, and they can do this so-called non-targeted analysis to measure pretty much anything. And so it's become a huge issue here in this state, generated in part by the Gen X controversy. Next slide. Our community engagement core is directed by Dr. Elizabeth Shapiro Garza, a professor here in the Nicholas School, and they have three key projects which I've tried to highlight here: community gardens, communities near formal industrial sites, brownfield sites, and subsistence fish consumers. And so they make heavy use too of the analytical chemistry core. They also have developed, like that top upper left picture is results of a GIS tools that they've created to help identify potential sources of hazardous chemicals that would might impact, for example, where you would locate a community garden. And they're also looking, for example, shown here with the town of Rocky Mount, to determine what risks might be associated with the development of a former mill site. And we're also doing a lot of work, particularly in the lower Cape Fear, with concerns for subsistence fishermen, people who are utilizing fish as a key source of their protein in areas that might have contamination, for example, by PCBs. Next slide. And our research translation core is directed by Charlotte Clark, and there's a number of activities shown here. I'll mention just a few up there on the upper left. You see Heather Stapleton testifying before Congress. Her testimony is instrumental in how to put down regulating flame retardants. We're involved in center-wide formal training. For example, they're now working with EPA here in RTP to develop a risk assessment experience class for our trainees. They do a lot in terms of helping trainees and faculty with communication skills. They basically direct all our social media, our websites and Facebooks and so forth. They have online networks related largely to children's health available to physicians, mothers, and so forth. And then lastly, they work a lot with various stakeholders. Here, this picture is the Elizabeth River Project is an NGO in Portsmouth, Virginia that's been real helpful with us. We worked with a lot on trying to communicate some of the issues in the Elizabeth River to the people in that region. They've recently partnered with the University of Kentucky and Penn Superfund sites to help with training of help with trainees and so forth. We just had a really interesting meeting in Washington, D.C., and then there's various other with, of course, our key outlet to NIHS, to CDC, and so forth. Next slide. So importantly, I just want to give thanks to Bill and Heather. They've been really great project officers for us, and we appreciate all they've done for us all the years. And we're happy to take questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich. And well, we have to thank you, the group at Duke, for all the excellent work that you have done over the years as part of your NIEHS Superfund research program. So thank you. And at this time, we are able to open Q&A time. So we invite people to use the Q&A pod to submit questions. In a minute, we will open it up to phone line participants to see if they have any questions for our Duke program. I wanted to start with a question about your interactions, I guess maybe particularly with the Elizabeth River, that there must be some changes that happen, you know, with the remediation plans, and I just wondered how your group is able to adapt. Obviously, the fish are adapting, but how are you able to adapt?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, the one real Superfund site in that river was the Atlantic Wood site that has been largely, I guess, the remediation is largely completed, if you will. They built a retaining wall around the hot spot. There's still concerns about, well, how much of that actual pollution did they gather? As Claudia mentioned, you know, we're actually studying about 8 sites. There's 2 other former wood treatment plant sites, and it's really interesting. One of them was remediated in a completely different way by trying to reestablish native wetlands, and the third one is Republic, which is in essence has become our new real hot spot because it's just about as hot as polluted by PAHs as Atlantic Wood, but there's nothing has been done yet. There are plans of the Elizabeth River Project is they're a great NGO, and they are working real hard with the Corps engineers and EPA and industries in the site to really clean up that river. So I know they eventually have plans to remediate Republic. So we have a great lab in that river of an enormous gradient pollution from fairly clean to very polluted. So we have had to adjust as remediation's gone on, but it's actually given us a great opportunity to look at, well, as they remediate, what happens to those adapted populations Do they go back to the regular, or do they have other issues and so forth?
Great. Well, that's good. I'm glad it has worked out, to your favor. Certainly, it helps advance the science when we, understand a wider range of pollution and even being able to test the effectiveness of different remediation approaches. So we do have a question. I'd like to turn to the online questions that are coming in. There was a question about the analytical capabilities that are being developed for untargeted analysis. And specifically, if you wanted to say a little bit more about the controversy that you referred to, I think that was maybe the Gen X is what they're referring to.
Sure. This is Lee Ferguson. I'll try to take those questions. In terms of the analytical capabilities, actually, we've had a real advancement in the last couple of years in the instrumentation that we're bringing to bear on non-targeted analysis. So specifically, my laboratory and Heather Stapleton's laboratory have a combination of high-resolution Orbitrap mass spectrometers, both HPLC Orbitrap as well as now a new GC Orbitrap system. And what these allow us to do is collect data on a broad range of contaminants simultaneously for both semi-volatile as well as non-volatile compounds in water, sediments, tissue, and other types of matrices. And importantly, one of the critical areas that we've been working on is data reduction and analysis strategies to identify organic contaminants from the mass spectral signatures, the high-resolution signatures. So it's a large effort in my laboratory and Heather's laboratory to basically provide these capabilities to the center researchers so that they can look for unconventional contaminants as well as perhaps transformation products. So that's been a lot of effort over the last few years, much of it well supported by Superfund. As far as the controversy, this is so the Gen X compound, for those who may not be familiar, is a polyfluorinated alkyl substance replacement for the C8 perfluorooctanoic acid that was manufactured by a company called Chemours, which is divested from DuPont a few years ago. The company had been releasing the Gen X compound into the Cape Fear River inadvertently since at least 2002, such that the drinking water concentrations in the city of Wilmington were at or above 1,000 part per billion in some cases. And so 1,000 part per trillion. I'm sorry, I misspoke. So this led to a lot of concern both in the in the public, the press, as well as eventually in the legislature, and the development of a lot of awareness over emerging contaminants in water. And so because of that, the legislature has funded a new program to assess occurrence and concentrations of polyfluorinated alkyl substances, non-targeted analysis of those compounds across the state of North Carolina in drinking water. And so we're part of that, and as well as other researchers around the state. So, again, this has some links back to the analytical chemistry core using our capabilities that we've developed. Right.
Thank you, Lee. I think that addresses the question at hand and certainly gives us a better perspective about what the analytical chemistry core is doing. I do want to give our phone line participants a chance to ask a question. If that pertains to you and you have a question, you're welcome to take your phone off mute and ask the question. The way you take your phone off mute is by pressing #6. That will unmute your phone. So I'll give folks just a minute to, again, press #6 in order to unmute your phone and ask a question. I think I'm hearing the crickets from Elizabeth River. if for some reason you wanted to ask a question or you were unable to, we encourage you to submit the questions as we go, or contact us at the end and we'll make sure to have your questions answered. Let's just take one more question at this point. Regarding the neurodevelopmental work with the diazinon,
Other organophosphate pesticides have been shown to have the DNT activity. So is your group seeing similar effects with this chemical?
Yeah, this is Ed Levin from Project One. Yeah, we're continuing on with diazinon. Yeah, previously we'd worked with diazinon somewhat and also with chlorpyrifos and parathion, and we are seeing neurochemical impacts and persisting behavioral effects actually at doses that cause minimal acetylcholinesterase inhibition. So, and those do vary among those, at least those three compounds that we tested. And so the kind of classical approach of, oh, if you're not substantially inhibiting acetylcholinesterase, then you're without risk is has been shown to not be true, and that the lower doses are having these persisting effects.
Great. Thank you for answering that question. And let's thank the Duke team for giving a wonderful presentation, a really nice overview of the work that you have just started. Many of these projects are underway. You know, again, as Dr. Sook mentioned, a lot of new approaches happening here. So we thank you for giving us an overview about the promise of the center, and look forward to seeing how your work continues in the future. And at this time, we will move to our other program who will be presenting today, and that is the University of Arizona, and we will hear from Dr. Raina Mayer. She's the director of the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program Center. She's a professor of environmental microbiology in the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science at the University of Arizona. We do have more information about Dr. Mayer's work on the CLUIN seminar homepage. So if you're interested, you can look that up there. And at this time, I will pass it off to Dr. Mayer to tell us about her center.
Thank you, Heather. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, you sound great.
Great, thank you. So I'd like to start by thanking NIEHS for providing this opportunity to learn about each other's Superfund centers. My name is Raina Mayer, and I lead the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program, which is in its 28th year, so it's an established program. Approximately 10 years ago, we shifted our focus to look at health issues surrounding metal mining. And here I have a fun fact for you. Arizona produces about 60% of the copper that's used in the United States. And in fact, a large portion of metals around the world are produced in arid or semi-arid environments, such as we have in Arizona. So the type of research we do is extensive, not only for Arizona, but also for around the world. As a society, we have a huge legacy of abandoned mine sites, and this is exemplified by the pictures shown in this title slide. So this is our field site, or one of our field sites, the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site. And on the left, you see an archival picture from 1950. And on the right, you see what the site looks like today, and there's really not much difference. So this next slide shows that because these abandoned and legacy sites hang around for a very, very long time, there's huge potential for disasters to occur as a result of historic mining activities. And I show four different examples in this slide. So residual mine waste is one of the largest waste streams in the world. In the upper left-hand corner, we see the Gold King mine spill, which happened in 2015 in Colorado. 3 million gallons of toxic waste containing over 2 tons of lead and 200 pounds of arsenic were released during this spill, affecting the Animas and Colorado rivers and Native nations that use the river water for irrigation. This occurred as a simple accident. EPA was doing some land moving near an adit, which is basically a tunnel into the mountain, that adit was opened, releasing all of this acid mine drainage. On the upper right-hand side is a satellite picture of the Samarco iron ore dam collapse. This collapse crushed an entire town, killing 19 people. And in this picture, you can see the mine tailings moving all the way into the Atlantic Ocean. On the bottom left is the Mount Polly tailings dam break. This occurred in Canada. And you can see the extent of the mine tailings moving into the pristine areas in Canada. And it's been called one of the biggest environmental disasters in modern Canadian history. And finally, on the lower right is the Cananea mine spill, which occurred in Mexico in 2014. This was a dam that was holding back a pregnant leach solution containing high levels of copper, and the dam broke and moved into the Sonora River, which serves a large farming region in the area that had been considered pristine, and there was a lot of organic farming going on. So I've just shown you four disasters, and in this next slide, I'm showing you a video, which is not a disaster. This is something that happens on a daily basis at the Superfund site that we work at. You can see the tailings being entrained into the air as the wind moves over the tailings. This mode of transportation for contaminants is especially important in arid and semi-arid regions that we are studying. I'll show you a picture later on where you'll see that as these tailings are entrained into the atmosphere and moving, they actually cross the highway and land into the neighboring community. So this is a slide that shows you an overview of the University of Arizona Superfund research program. And again, we focus on studying and solving the health issues related to legacy and abandoned mining waste. This slide shows a cartoon of a mine tailing site, the neighboring community. And we have five research projects that look at, first, characterization of airborne dust and modeling of dust movement. Second, characterization of groundwater contamination and development of innovative remediation technologies for that contamination. Third, phytoremediation of mine tailings to reduce dust emissions and movement of tailings. And then our two biomedical projects look at the toxicology of inhaled dust and dietary interventions for dust inhalation. So for the remainder of the talk, I am going to introduce one of our field sites and then provide a little more description of each research project and core. But I do want to emphasize that the most important mission of our Superfund research program is the training of our students and postdocs. And we routinely involve and, in fact, require our students to participate in community engagement and research translation efforts to give a context to the research they're doing and to learn the importance of involving not only communities but other stakeholders as well in their research. So this is a picture of a satellite image of the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site, which is one of the two sites that we work at. And let me draw your attention first to our study site, which is outlined in red. This is the mine tailings site itself, and it's a little over 150 acres of mine tailings. And if you recall the video I just showed you, The primary direction of wind movement is from the left to right in this slide. So you can see that the wind is lifted off those mine tailings and into the town of Dewey Humboldt, which is on the right of the side of the slide, outlined in yellow. And in fact, EPA has already done two sets of yard removals because of contamination at the site. Okay, so what kind of contamination? The mine tailings themselves, they have a pH of 2 to 3, and they have contents of arsenic, lead, and zinc that exceed 3,000 milligrams per kilogram. So it's a highly contaminated material, and the low pH of the material prevents plants from naturally establishing and growing on the site. Also on this slide, you can see outlined in green an area where there used to be a smelter. That area is also highly contaminated with metal. And if you look carefully at the image, you can see that there are a lot of dry washes, which when it rains, run heavily with water. And this has contributed to moving this contamination from the smelter site area into the surrounding environment. And similarly, if you look back at the study site outlined in red and look very closely at the mine tailings pile, you can see in the bottom right-hand corner of the rectangle, there is an area of the tailings that is blown out. And that occurred during a heavy rainfall event some years ago. And again, those mine tailings have moved into the surrounding environment. So let me give you a little more information about each of our projects. Project 1 is focused on dust emission and weather forecasting. It's run by three scientists from the College of Engineering and College of Science, Eduardo Saez, Eric Betterton, and Armin Sarushian. And really, they are assessing the movement of aerosols and their deposition. And they also do cutting-edge source apportionment. And why are we interested in source apportionment? Well, mining operators need to understand where contamination might be coming from in their processing facilities. So this could be coming from where the ore is being crushed and processed. It could be coming from mine tailing sites. And unless you can identify the source of the dust, it's hard to know where you should put your efforts in controlling the dust. And they're using isotope analysis to do this source apportionment. They are also combining aerosol modeling with weather forecasting. And that's being done to help predict dust movement and times of the year, or time, in fact, times on a daily basis, where companies need to enforce dust control efforts. One really interesting finding of this project that has recently come to light is that they are studying the hygroscopic properties of dust. And by hygroscopic properties, I mean that if you have a dry dust particle and you put it in a humid environment like the respiratory tract, it can actually grow in size because it absorbs to water. And it turns out that the size fractions of the dust that we're collecting, so the smaller size fractions have elevated concentrations of arsenic. And that means that these very small particles, you would expect that you would breathe them in and then exhale them right out again. But due to hygroscopicity, as you breathe in these very small particles, they actually grow in size and then are deposited in the lung. And that means an increased health risk. Our second project is focusing right now on the bioremediation of uranium plumes, particularly in Arizona, where we have a great depth to groundwater. And they are looking at whether you can sequester the uranium in situ by using an ethanol injection to promote microbial activity and sequestration of not only the uranium, but also associated sulfate and nitrate. So I'm showing you here an experiment that was done at the Monument Valley UMTRA site. And the gray area in the figure on the right is the uranium plume. And in the very center of that plume is a test site where they did a 3-day ethanol injection. And then downstream from the injection, they collected for the next several years samples to look at uranium, sulfate, and nitrate concentrations. And if you look at the graph on the left, you can see that following this 3-day 1% ethanol injection, the concentrations of sulfate, nitrate, and uranium dropped to background levels, and this was maintained for about 1,000 days or 2.5 years before rebounding. And so this looks like it might be a very cost-effective approach to maintaining the plumes so that the contaminants don't move off-site. Project 3 is my project. I work with Dr. Julie Nelson, Dr. John Chorover, and Dr. Mark Barton, and we are looking at phytoremediation of mine tailings. Work that we've done collectively over the last few years has shown that the work that we do in the greenhouse scales very well to the field. So we can determine what amendments need to be added to have successful plant growth in the field. If we determine that in the greenhouse, it actually works in the field. We also have worked with Project One, our dust modeling group, and they have been able to evaluate dust emissions from the Iron King site in the absence and presence of the vegetation that we've established. And we have shown that vegetation significantly reduces dust transport off the site. In fact, plants appear to sequester dust and associated contaminants as it moves over the planted areas. What we are working on right now is to try and understand when this technology begins to fail. So why are some areas in our field trial working very well, and why do some areas look a little more like the slide, the picture on the right, where you see that the plants are sort of dying back at the edges of the plot? It turns out that it's the acidification, a re-acidification process that goes on that causes these plants to fail. And we have been looking at the microbial community and its role in the success or failure of the plants to establish. And we've found there's actually a war going on. That war occurs between plant growth promoting bacteria that keep plants healthy, and bacteria that like to acidify the environment. And we have discovered new groups of bacteria that like to acidify that operate at much higher pHs than previously understood. And so there is a whole community that operates consecutively to drive the acidification process from pH 6 all the way back down to pH 2.2 to 3. It's not a single population, rather a community of populations that works one after another to drive this process. So we are trying to understand that in order to prevent the process from occurring. We have two biomedical projects, and the first is led by Dr. Clark Lance, Scott Boitano, and Donna Zhang, and they are exposing mice to real-world dust collected from the Iron King mine. Our engineers have built an apparatus for us so we can actually collect tailings, and in the lab we can generate dust, and that would be equivalent to what you see on site. And this group is measuring EMT markers in response to these exposures. And what you can see in the table on the right is that for in utero exposures, some EMT markers are affected. For postnatal exposures only, a single EMT marker is affected. But when you combine both in utero and postnatal exposures, almost all the EMT parameters are impacted. And the current hypothesis this group is working on is that in utero exposure may prime the lung for responding to subsequent postnatal exposures. Our second biomedical project is led by Donna Zhang, also with Clark Lance and Scott Vitano, and they are interested in the detailed mechanism by which arsenic causes lung inflammation and malfunction. They focus on a transcript called NRF2 and its canonical and non-canonical pathways of expression. So usually NRF2 is produced intermittently, but when arsenic is present, it looks like it may have this non-canonical pathway and sustained expression, tipping the role of NRF2 from protective to harmful. This group is looking at a compound called sulforaphane, which is thought to stimulate the canonical pathway and functioning of NRF2, which would then protect against arsenic toxicity. We have a huge effort to reach out to stakeholders. Dr. Carletta Chief leads our effort to reach out to Native Nations. We do a lot of different mining exercises. For example, in the upper right left corner is muffin mining at Earth Day, where students learn about mining and taking apart the soil to get the valuable ore, and then what do you do with the mess that's left over. We create educational mining modules. We were the first to produce a fact sheet for understanding the Gold King mine spill, and we have testified several times in front of Congress on the Gold King mine spill. We also have an effort called Garden Roots, which is a citizen science program to empower communities neighboring contamination. This is led by Dr. Monica Ramirez, and she developed this in response to community concern about eating homegrown vegetables. And the question really comes down to, is it healthier to eat homegrown vegetables grown in a garden that may have elevated levels of some contaminants like arsenic, but also have elevated levels of plant nutrients, versus buying your vegetables from the store, and these vegetables may have less nutrition in them, but lower levels of arsenic. She has run with this program, and it is now an Arizona-wide program called Project Harvest. I also want to comment that we have monthly to quarterly calls with regulatory agencies concerning the Superfund sites we work at, and this includes EPA Region 9, ATSDR Region 9, the Arizona Department of Health Services, and the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. And finally, I just want to mention one outgrowth of this work. There's been so much excitement by our stakeholders for the work that we're generating that we created a Center for Environmentally Sustainable Mining. And our mission is to develop educational and research initiatives to address environmental issues related to mining activities, particularly in arid and semi-arid environments. So this is a research translation vehicle to support Arizona communities, industry, and policymakers. It's a pillar for our mining research efforts at the University of Arizona, and it supports the Superfund research program and various other projects here at Arizona. Our resounding success from the center is an industry academic cooperative for reclamation that's led by Dr. Julie Nelson. This is a partnership with Grupo Mexico, KGHM International, and Rio Tinto, with a fourth mining company that is currently joining. Together, we address critical components of active mining operations. So our Superfund program is focused on legacy operations, legacy mines, and this is actually on modern mining active operations. We require all partners to share all information. We get together once a year to discuss research results and share expertise. And the goal is to both protect the environment and to reduce operating costs. And this was started in 2014, and these mining companies have already committed through 2020. So with that, I'd love to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Raina.
Thank you. That was a really nice overview of the work that your center is doing, as well as some of the sites on which you have used kind of to develop your conceptual site model for that has helped inform the direction of your center. I will encourage people to submit questions in the Q&A pod. And in just a moment, I will turn it over to anyone on the phone lines who may have some questions. One question that came up was about the percent dust emission reduction. And related to that, is that related to any particular percentage cover of plants, and whether that is similar to guidance from such as Bureau of Land Management or other agencies that might make recommendations about cover on mine tailings?
Yeah, so we studied two plots at 16% plant cover and 32% plant cover. And the 32% plant cover is pretty equivalent to the surrounding area. So that's what would be sort of normal for the area. And not only did it reduce dust emission, but it actually removed dust from the air moving over. And it can the amount of dust emitted goes from a fairly large amount to what would be expected for a 32% canopy cover. I believe I give the citation on the slide. So this work just got published a few months ago, and the details are in there as well.
Great, thank you. Another question that came up is with regard to the sulforaphane and whether that's heat label.
Whether it's heat label?
Right.
Good question. I do not know the answer, but if the person that asked that question wants to contact me, I will make sure to get you the answer.
Sure. In fact, we can put you in touch with
the question. That'd be great.
When you do have an answer. Yeah, that's great. And we encourage people to ask wacky questions like that, because we're happy to get back to you with the answers.
Yeah.
So thanks, Raina.
Yeah.
Okay, another question came about the non-canonical pathway for NRF 2. Could you speak more about how this works?
Oh my gosh. Again, I'm not the best one to talk about this. This is Donna Zhang's project. But it has to do with the NRF2 transcript and how the expression of NRF2 is regulated. And there is apparently a dysregulation that causes sustained production of NRF2 when you have arsenic presence. And that leads to this dysfunction. So Donna Zhang calls it the dark side of NRF2. NRF2 is usually thought of as a protective transcript during oxidative stress, but it's normally only produced intermittently. But if you produce it in a sustained way, you get a bad outcome. Again, if you get in touch with me, I'll put you in touch with Donna Zhang, and she will give you more information.
Great, that sounds like a plan. let's see if anybody from our phones would like to ask a question. Again, in order to be able to ask your question, you'll need to take yourself off mute. And the way you do that is by pressing #6 to take yourself off mute. And in the meantime, we encourage people to use the Q&A pod to submit questions as well. Okay, now I'm hearing the particles of dust over the Gold King mine. Again, not much happening on the phones. But as we're talking about the particles on the Gold King mine, with the monitoring that you're doing, it sounds like it's very sophisticated and sensitive. And I was wondering, you know, with all the wildfires happening out west, if you're able to pick up even on some of that. I remember you mentioned source apportionment.
So you mean how the wildfires might affect what's in the dust?
Right. If there's any, you know, it, like evidence that some of the particles you're seeing might be transported or might have characteristics that would be more likely to come from a wildfire than, say, some of the mining activities.
So you're exactly right. The isotope fingerprinting analysis can certainly do that type of source apportionment. We don't have any current measurements to look at wildfires, but certainly would be possible to do. And it's intriguing,
okay,
right? Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it's certainly something that we are, you know, that certain regions of our nation and around the world are having to deal with.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I don't see any more questions.
Heather, another question just came through.
Oh, okay. Do you mind asking that question?
Sure.
Thanks.
Yep. So the question is, I am curious how the Community Engagement Corps project of Voices Unheard, an oral history project, how it is going and how that project is conducted.
Okay, that's a great question. I didn't even mention that one. So we have a graduate student who is very interested in developing oral histories at two of the Superfund sites here in Arizona. And she is currently doing video interviews of, she's done a lot of research, yeah, let me back up for a minute. She's done a lot of research on selecting community members to provide the oral histories. She's now in the process of collecting video interviews of all of these people. And, you know, it's early days yet, but one of the fascinating things that she has found at the Iron King mine site that I've been talking about today is that there was a large Mexican community that participated in the mining process in the early 1900s, which is when the mine opened. And basically, the voice of these Hispanic workers has not ever really been heard and has been sort of washed out of the history of the area. And so she's making that discovery, and I think her oral history will be a valuable contribution to add that voice back into the history of the area. She has a website called Voices Unheard, if any of you are interested in taking a look. But this is very much ongoing research.
Great. Thank you, Raina. At this time, we do have time to ask questions of either of the centers. And so if as questions are coming in, I can ask them to our presenters. And again, I want to encourage you, there will be some upcoming webinars about the other newly funded Superfund research centers. And but again, we think this is a great way for potential stakeholders, other types of audience, other academics, regulators, et cetera, to learn about the kind of work that the centers are doing. And so we encourage people to listen in. And something that we didn't mention is that there is a call out on the streets, as we call it at NIH, for the P42 centers. So each time that there is a request for applications, there are slight modifications. So the work that you're hearing today and in some of those upcoming webinars maybe slightly different than what is called for in the existing RFA, but if you or your organization, these are university center grants, if you are interested in applying, we encourage you to look that up. The number is ES18002, and we can even leave that in the resources page for anyone who might be interested. But as you can see, they require a lot of planning, and so we do encourage people to contact us early on in the system. Okay, so we did get a question that I think is related to Duke and a recent publication that came out about swimming C. elegans. And Joel, maybe that's something that relates if you're still on the line?
Yes, I am still on the line, and I'm happy to talk about that.
Okay, great. Yeah, the question was how you relate that to human health.
Sure. So the where we're trying to relate it is really at the level of the mitochondrial function itself, and mitochondrial function is very highly conserved among different species. So the idea that we're working on there is that exercise alters mitochondrial function, and mitochondria, of course, are critical for providing energy, and so they respond well when we use them. And we're looking at chemicals that then affect mitochondria, and what we're finding is that exercise in C. elegans, like in other organisms, including people, improves the function of mitochondria, really, in this case, over the lifespan of the worms, which, of course, is only a few weeks, so it's something we're able to look at pretty quickly. And it also protects them against exposures to chemicals like rotenone that are mitochondrial toxicants. So, you know, a worm is not a person, but a worm's mitochondria are very similar to a person's mitochondria. So this gives us hope that we could use C. elegans as a model to ask this kind of question.
Okay, so in the short term, it's not necessarily a recommendation to increase swimming.
Well, I think the recommendation would be that exercise in general, swimming is the best way we have to exercise worms. I think that exercise in general is probably a very good idea. It clearly improves health in a lot of ways in people. Now, we don't have actual data on whether, to my knowledge, to whether it improves resistance to toxic exposures in people, but again, based on the conservation of that biology, I would have every reason to think that it would.
Great. Well, thanks for saying a little bit more about that work. Looks like we have another question for University of Arizona. The question is regarding the Mexican community working on the mines discovered in the Voices Unheard for the Dewey-Humboldt community or the Hyden-Winkleman community. I'm looking for the question. I think the question is is it with regard to that community that
It's in regard to the Dewey-Humboldt community that neighbors the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site.
Okay, great. Thanks for clarifying that.
Mm-hmm.
And while I have you, Raina, what sort of work or evaluations have you done related to the Gold King Mine spill?
So there are a lot of ongoing studies there. There's been a lot of citizen science work and training to teach the communities how to sample. So it's really hard to know when you have a 3 million gallon spill where the contaminants end up. And so there needs to be a concerted sampling effort to determine where hot spots of contamination may end up. So there's been a lot of training of community health representatives and local citizens in the community to take samples and submit samples to the University of Arizona for analysis. And this is partly so that they can make the decision of whether to use the water from the river for irrigation of their crops. So that's one major area that we've been working in.
Great. Thanks. I know that the work that you've been doing is not only very important, but very timely. And
It's really meant to empower the communities to understand what happened and to be able to do some of the science themselves.
Excellent. We do have another question about engagement, community engagement, only for the Duke side. And I wonder if someone on the line from Duke would be willing to just say a little bit more about what the Community Engagement Corps, what communities the Engagement Corps is working with. And maybe we can even flip the screen back to the CEC for Duke. It looks like maybe somebody's moving it in that direction.
Okay, this is Rich. Unfortunately, Liz has left the room. Joel and I are the only ones in here left, but I can try to answer that to some degree. So they've established a relationship with, I want to say, about a dozen community gardens in the state, some in Durham, but some further west. And I know they're doing a lot with Forsyth County, which is where Winston-Salem is, and they're also doing with some communities further east. And in all those cases, they've established relationships with the local soil, the county soil scientists and so forth. And so it's actually, and so then they go there and they'll meet with those people as well as the gardeners themselves. You know, in most cases, it's not the gardeners haven't given a lot of thought to chemical contamination, but that's why they want to say, well, yeah, which is, they have to be real careful. You don't want to get people afraid to garden by any means, but you want to just sort of be aware, well, did you take into consideration site location? You don't want to be near an old underground tank and things like that. So that, and so the community garden is certainly one of their bigger efforts. The brownfield site, the most mature one, so the CEC, just as a heads up, it's the one completely new core we have. I mean, we did not have a community engagement core until this round, so they're not as, say, mature as the RTC and the chemistry core and so forth. But they're doing a lot of work with the town of Rocky Mount. They've been down there several times meeting with, I believe in this case, mostly county and city officials, who have this pretty large abandoned, essentially, mill site that's shown in that picture there. And they want to redevelop it. And then the questions of what are the appropriate uses? Could it be a playground, a ballpark, or what? And so that's where I know they need to think about, well, what did this mill do? What chemicals should we measure and so forth? And then the third one is this fish consumption. There's a lot of concern for certain communities, mainly along the coast, and they're mainly focusing on the lower Cape Fear River. So the lower Cape Fear River is, you know, the river is one of the major rivers in North Carolina that flows into Wilmington. And so then it becomes a key water source for the city of Wilmington. Plus, it's a pretty major fishery, both for recreational fishing and commercial fishing. And there's a number of poor people who, you know, feed tremendously on catfish and shad, which is shown here in that river. And there's certainly concerns for, you know, historic concerns for chemicals like PCBs and mercury. And of course, you heard from Lee, this whole Gen X thing has raised a huge red flag. And I know there's a lot of monitoring going on, including that network that Lee talked about for the perfluorinated compounds, including Gen X. And this kind of, this part sort of grew out of our earlier work that the RTC was helping us with on fish consumption in the Elizabeth River that Heather and Bill helped us with those with administrative supplement, where we there was concern about PCB contamination of redfish and speckled trout. It's kind of surprisingly that river is a very industrialized river, but it's become like a trophy fish system, believe it or not. And so people are worried about that. I have to say, our analyses did not indicate levels of PCBs of concern, so that was a good thing. So that's the three major projects. Joel's going to chime in here.
Yeah, I just want to add one other piece to that, which is actually sort of in parallel to what it sounds like Arizona is doing, which I think is wonderful. And that's the CEC works with all of our trainees, and there's at least one level. So every trainee that we have that's supported by Superfund engages with some of the CEC activities, which, as Raina said, and we completely agree, it provides really important context, I think, to the trainees for why they're doing the science and research they're doing. And so, you know, we do our best to have really strong science training, but also have that context and that exposure to the community engagement work. And then those trainees that are interested can also go on to a sort of deeper level of engagement, at almost more like an internship with the CEC. So the CEC has been really great in creating a bridge between those communities, not just with the PIs and researchers and research projects, but with the trainees themselves as well.
Good point.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing a little bit more about your community engagement core, as well as how you've been able to incorporate your trainees, who would be the graduate students in your program, and involve them in some of those activities. I will give the phone lines one more chance to ask a question. To do that, you know what? I'm not going to bother because they've been pretty quiet during the other breaks, and I'm running out of jokes about crickets and everything. So maybe we'll just make that an opportunity for people to reach out to the email addresses that you will find on the seminar homepage. And in fact, that's a good segue, because I want to make sure that you all are aware of the related URLs pod, which contains information about the seminar resources and the seminar feedback links. And we're now looking at that page. And let me just say, we've really enjoyed seeing the questions come through, and we've even gotten a few positive responses from people saying, oh, I'm really interested in seeing what happens with Project 4 or 5. So I would really encourage those of you, while the Q&A pod is still open, just go ahead, and if there are any projects with which you would like to have a little more information or a little more updates as things happen, or maybe you know of ways that research could be used elsewhere, if you don't mind sending a little Q&A to that effect, I will not read it aloud, but it is something that we can pass on to our presenters. And again, that's the whole reason why we wanted to do these presentations. Again, this is the promise of research, and it's a little bit different than a lot of times when you tune in to Clue In, you'll be hearing about research that has already completed and what the results were. So this is a little bit different, And we encourage this early interaction to really maximize the impact of the research that is underway. So along those lines, we do have these seminar resources for you, and it will stay with the seminar indefinitely. And the seminar archive will also be available in about a week's time. In fact, if you are the registrant for this seminar, then you will get an email that tells you when that archive is available. And so again, along the same lines, if you saw something during today's webinar that you thought, oh, you know what, I really need to let my colleague so-and-so know about the work that's happening in Project 6, we encourage you to forward that email that has the link to the archive and really connect people in your world with some of the research that's happening here within the Superfund research program. So we hope that this this seminar can be a nexus to connect people between the research and its application someday. So again, you will get that email, and it will give you access to the webinar as it was today. You will also find a seminar feedback form on the related URLs. And so we really enjoy getting the feedback, positive or negative. It helps us improve our format. And the other thing is that if you need a confirmation email, you can go to the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. So with that, I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected so that you won't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter, Tech Direct, and follow the CLUIN on the Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn resources. We also encourage you to visit the SRP website for more information about the program. You can also follow SRP on Twitter. And lastly, I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the September 10 and October 1. All of these webinars start at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And these are the next three sessions in the series. Again, we will be talking about the promise of some of the research that is coming out of some of the newly funded Superfund research centers. You can visit the CLUIN registration pages for more information about each session and to register. If you would like to join the webinars, you can register now. If you cannot attend, again, the archives will be made available after the event. You'll get a nice little email, probably from Jean Ballant. And so we encourage you to come back to these pages or pass them along to people who you think would be interested in the webinar that you just heard. So with that, it is time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question or comment, we will certainly try to get back to it at a later time. If you do have any additional questions, again, the emails are on the web page, so we encourage you to get in touch with us that way. I would like to give our appreciation to Duke University and University of Arizona. It's really hard to distill lots and lots of research into just a few slides, and you all did a wonderful job doing that. I think everybody got a good sense of the research that you have and that's underway. And we thank you for sharing your presentations with us today. Lastly, Sarah is in the background and making sure everything runs correctly. And Sarah, thank you so much for putting out a few of the fires that we had behind the scenes, because it seemed to run smoothly on the outside, we hope. So that concludes today's presentation. Thank you again for your participation, and we hope to hear you on September 4th, or see you on September 4th.